podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
They might talk about humor, music, film, books, football and box sets, exercise and maybe even food. Trivia and sport, politics and health, sometimes well-being too. On the Life with Brian. On the Life with Brian.
Hello and welcome once again to Life with Brian. I'm your host Mark and I'm joined as ever by, of course, Brian McClair. Hiya Brian, how's things?
Good evening, I'm very well, how are you?
Well, not too bad, thank you very much. And Matthew, nice to see you again, how are you?
Yeah, hello Mark, hello Brian, hello everyone, good to be back.
And once again, we have a special guest with us. This week, we are joined by musician, bassist with Ocean Colour Scene and Jerry Cinnamon, Ray Mead. Welcome to the show, Ray. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, okay then, guys. Do you want to tell us how you met? How did this wonderful friendship develop over the years?
Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course I do, yeah. But it's like, as was mentioned before, is that some people's version, your version and my version, might be completely different, or indeed might have no connections whatsoever. I do remember, yeah. Do you want me to tell my version first, or do you want me to tell your version first?
No, you go for it. It's your show.
I believe it was in a hotel in Glasgow at the Scottish Professional Football Association dinner a few years ago in the green room.
That was it.
Is that how you recall?
Yep.
And I was crying in a corner because nobody recognised me. Nobody was paying any attention to me. And the kind soul came over with a consoling arm and said, "Don't worry about it. You're my 68th favourite Celtic supporter of the 80s.
Do you remember what you actually said? Because I remember that happening.
It might have been something rude. So
it wasn't rude, but you said, "You're not a footballer. Look at your legs." That's the first thing you ever said to me.
Clearly you're not a footballer.
Were you wearing shorts? How did you know what your legs, what his legs?
Well, that's
like
what I'm thinking. Oh. I was wearing a suit. You know, but
two drain cleaners hanging out of a pair of hanging out beneath a dinner jacket. That's how I realised. It's a bit like meeting Pat Nevin. You know, you almost immediately, you know, you're going to get on with someone. Raymond was clearly friendly with Tony Higgins, who was the ex-chairman of the Scottish Professional Football Players Association, who had worked with before Raymond was born, who is someone who's one of the funniest people I've ever met in their mind, one of the funniest ex-football players. So once you mentioned the right things and then started talking about music and football right away, it was going to be a good thing. Did we swap telephone numbers, or did we give you numbers on the back of napkins? What did we do? Anyways,
we hooked up.
We had a memorable second date. We had a nice blind date, but we had a pretty memorable second date. But that's how we met. So
were you a fan? Were you a fan of Raymond's music? I mean, were you the groupie this time, or was it the other way around?
It was the other way around. He was one of my favourite players growing up in the kind of that golden period for United. I saw him standing, and he was just standing on his own, and he looked raging. He looked in a really bad mood, and I thought, am I going to say hello to him? And then I thought, no, I'll go over and chance it. And I think we started talking about the Pogues, if I'm not mistaken, and from then on it was quite obvious it was a mutual love of that band and other bands as well. So I think we swapped messages on Twitter a couple of days later, And we did have a memorable second date. Indeed. Now I'm thinking about it. Yeah, it was quite memorable.
Well, you can't not divulge that information now, can you? Both mentioned this.
They said that the next time I was, well, we were about, we'd meet up and we'd meet up. I think that was the second time, wasn't it, when we met at the pub and your dad was there, wasn't it?
That's the day I'm thinking of. Yep. And
yeah, the first proper date was Raymond said, "Did you mind if he brought his dad along?"
Was this some kind of chaperone? Was he?
Yeah, chaperone. Yeah, well, it worked out well that way with a chaperone because your dad was involved at Albion Rovers, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was for years and years. He was the chairman there.
Which is the football team in Coatbridge, Matthew, which you all know nothing about.
Oh, I know everything about Coatbridge. You know that.
You don't know there's a football team there.
Well, I do now.
So it was good. It was good actually because it ended up that Raymond was a chaperone because he never actually got the chance to say a single thing. Me and his dad just chatted about football. And every time that there was I kept kind of looking to give Raymond an opportunity to get in. And just as he was about to get in, it was a bit like the Jason Higgins kind of thing. His dad would swipe him. Right. No, so I'm talking. You'll get a chance in a minute. And then after 6 pints of Stella later, I think it was time for, it was in the afternoon, wasn't it? So it was 6 pints of Stella later. It was time for your dad to go.
Well, he went home in the bus, and I remember my mum texting me saying, "Where have you been? What's happened here?" Do you know what I mean? He was upside down. It was hilarious, but I think he enjoyed himself.
Have you seen him since, Brian? Have you drinking him under the table?
No.
Is that?
No, I don't think he's been allowed out.
No, you saw him at the gig. I think you saw him again.
I did a song, but I think he was. Any time that I was mentioned, I think hopefully he did what you do in many occasions like that, particularly if your missus doesn't know you, where you blame the other person. So hopefully I got the blame for it, you know. He wouldn't let me go, you know what it's like, you know. Because I think we had one for the road 3 times.
Oh yeah, and it was only about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was early.
I take it your dad is your dad as big a fan of Brian as you were as a kid, or was he a different era?
No, I mean when we were growing up, you know, whole Celtic Rangers thing in Glasgow. I think because he grew up a big Albion Rovers fan. He wasn't interested in the Old Firm. I think he wanted it to be like that for my brother and me, you know, so we were Man United supporters, you know, from a young age, and I think that was to do with Sir Alex, you know, and obviously the kind of glory years that followed in the 90s and all that kind of thing. It was a good time to be a United fan, but obviously having not such a prominent Scot in the team and stuff was a buzz, you know, it was brilliant. So I think he's a big admirer of his playing, aye.
And his drinking, I'm sure now.
I've got a couple of musings.
Oh, go on.
Mark.
Oh, here we go.
Well, you know, again, there's plenty of time to be considering things and thinking about things. And a couple of things have been puzzling me. And I was wondering if anybody's got any answers to these little conundrums that are you know, nagging at me. And one of them was, you know, how to take the perfect photograph of the moon. That was one. And another one that's probably a little bit stranger is for a long time, talking about Alex Ferguson, Manchester United, for a long time, I've been wondering how to send a copy of Alex Ferguson's biography or autobiography to Iran. So they're the two little things that have been niggling me. I don't know if any of you have got any kind of...
Yeah, I can definitely tell
you. Well, I can help you with the second one. I can help you with the second one, but not the first one.
Go tell us how to do the second one then, because I'd like to know how you send a book to Iran.
Well, generally you send things to Iran through another country.
Economically.
You send it to Turkey and then they can take it in from Turkey.
I'm not interested in spending a load of money here.
Do you know how much it is to send a book? My quote from DHL to send a copy of this book was £93. So that's not going to be happening, is it? I don't know anyone in Turkey that can forward it on. I don't know anyone over there. And as for the moon, I got a telescope at Christmas. And that's how I've been passing a lot of the time at night, is sitting taking photographs.
Howling at the moon.
Howling at the moon. You just use an iPhone through the eyepiece and there you go. Dead simple.
What if you've not got an iPhone?
We can't. You're not going to be able to do it. You need to get an iPhone.
What if you've not got a telescope?
You need to get a telescope.
That doesn't fit in with the economy, this kind of idea of taking pictures of the moon. I thought you maybe just got closer, no? Just went up, found somebody that's got a high flat, in the high flat somewhere, up onto the roof, take pictures because you're a bit closer.
There's plenty near Coke Bridge, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's high flats in Coke Bridge, yeah.
I live in the top floor.
I don't know if there's any, not of a high flat, you don't. You live in the top floor of a condominium.
It's a tenement.
The West End.
Oh, it's a tenement now, is it?
Tenement.
They don't call them tenements in the West End, do they? They've got a more posher name than that.
Like, what, condominium?
Apartment.
Yeah, apartment. No, the thing about Iran, can I clear this up just because that is quite random? There's a girl in Iran called Parisa Portaherian. I read this article about her, and it turns out she's a sports photographer, and because she's a female, she can't get into the stadiums to photograph football. She's a mad football fan and a diehard Manchester United fan, and I wanted to do a podcast with her, basically just tell her story a little bit, because her dream is to photograph Manchester United at Old Trafford. So I thought it would be amazing if I could maybe brought her from Iran to Manchester and done that, maybe take her to Celtic Park and show her a bit of Glasgow. But it turns out it was too dangerous for her. So I wanted to, I don't know, I just felt, I thought it was quite a mad story. But the part I'm missing out is that every weekend she climbs onto a roof of an adjacent building and photographs the games just through a love of football. And it's amazing, you know. I thought that was totally inspiring. So I had this copy of Ali Ferguson's book that was signed. I actually had a couple of copies, and I wanted to send this book to Iran and see trying to get it there. It's still sitting packaged up, trying to get it to go. Because I like her story and stuff, but £95 feels steep to send a book at the moment for. For all musicians through this pandemic, do you know what I mean? But hopefully I'll get it over to her at some point. And even better, hopefully one day we can get her to Old Trafford, you know, because I think it's quite amazing. You know, just we've kind of got it easier, haven't we? You know, like compared to, you're just not allowed in a stadium because you're a girl or whatever. And it's crazy. It's mad.
Yeah, I went to Iran once, and coincidentally, speaking about Manchester United, the hotel that I was staying in, and the event that I was there for, was also housing the Iranian national team at the time. And the manager or head coach of the Iranian national team was Carlos Queiroz from Manchester United. Yeah. So it was a strange place, Iran, but fascinating and surprising nonetheless. As you can imagine, being cut off from most of the rest of the world, they're very ingenious people. Certainly very business orientated. So if there's a solution that needs to be found, they'll find it. You know, they're very adaptable people, certainly in the face of what they've, you know, had to put up with or endure for one reason or another in the last, whatever, 40 years or something, and economic sanctions and so on. So, yeah, it's a peculiar place. But, yeah, there's the Man United connection and football straight away. And they had English football on all the TVs, believe it or not. I went to a restaurant expecting to see lots of peculiar foods and everything else. And there they had HP sauce that somebody'd smuggled back into the restaurant. Whoever owned the restaurant had smuggled back, or their relative had.
Maybe somebody sent it to them for 95 and... quid.
Very possibly. But it was also, you always felt like you were under surveillance because, again, when I arrived there at the hotel, you had to give your passport up. And no matter how many times I requested it in the 4 or 5 days I was there, they said, oh, don't worry, it's fine with us, it's fine with us. But of course, you knew that it was a way to the Secret Service for them to monitor and so on. So, yeah, it's a peculiar place, but certainly somewhere that was worth visiting at least once, which, you know, I have done.
But you might be going back soon with a book.
Ray, as a musician, how have you found the last 12 months during the COVID pandemic? How have you had to adapt and be creative with what you do and how you get your work out there?
Oh, it's been a nightmare. You know, there's no dressing it up. It's been horrendous for everyone involved in the music industry, not just people in bands, but crews and backline crew and all the people that make the shows happen are really struggling. There's been very little to no support. I think that, you know, it's been life changing, really. You know, it's kind of, you've had to rethink everything, what you do. So many people, myself included, we live month to month. You know, you may be coming off a tour and doing another one, and you're planning, and for that, you know, to just be pulled out from under your feet has been difficult to say the least. With regards to, you know, the creative sort of side of things, I've been doing a lot of recording at home, whereas I would normally be in a studio or whatever, you know. But yeah, it's been pretty difficult. I think that, you know, I haven't been doing as much as I would normally been doing. My focus has been out with music in the last 12 months.
One of the poignant little tales that you mentioned to me, Raymond, was about the girl, I think it was, that, if I'm not, tell me what I'm correct or not about, was it with regards to the ancillary and the support that goes around about music, where a lot of people just used to assume you either listen to it in whatever media you listen to, or you go and watch things, but there's an awful lot of stuff that happens for that live event to take place, and you need and you need people to be there to do various different things. And I think it was a girl, who was it a lighting company she had, who she had to go and get a job in the checking out a supermarket. Was that right?
Yeah, I know lots of people, lots of crew that are elite level at what they do. The best of the best. You know, don't worry, name specific names or whatever, but I think it's all too familiar a tale to hear someone so qualified, you know, as to be touring with some of the biggest names in music, not just big British bands. I'm talking, you know, mega famous acts that find themselves in supermarkets to, you know, to make ends meet, you know, because they're not getting the support from the government, and their answer is, well, go and retrain. It's really fucking offensive, that, you know. Retrain is what? Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm all ears. Do what? You know, this. I thought it was such an arrogant, typical conservative approach, that, you know, just like, oh, just be gone, do something else. Yeah, do something else. It's a luxury very few people can afford, you know, it's to retrain at that stage of life. And why should they? You know, I mean, they spent all their lives getting so good at what they do to that level, whether when they're touring, you know, that life's pretty comfortable, you know. But no one could have seen this coming. The maddest thing is, it's the same for people at my level as it is for people that play with Paul McCartney's band or play with The Who or whatever. Do you mean nobody can tour, nobody can play? Everyone's just hoping, really, that, you know, there's going to be some sort of breakthrough. I've got dates in the diary for, you know, in the summer and stuff, and crossing my fingers. Actually, I picked out a couple of guitars today to just start working on some of the Ocean Colour Scene set that came through the other day. But, you know, you've just got to hope that they're going to, you know, at least try and put these events back on. Fair enough if they do it and there's a massive spike and there's loads of deaths and all the rest of it, you go, right, okay, fair enough. But I'm not convinced that's what's going to happen, especially with the vaccine. Do you know what I mean? I think they need to get it back in the road because it's affecting so many people. You know, it's been devastating.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, you've got obviously some big gigs lined up in the summer, but you're not particularly, you know, you think it's 50-50, or are you just being cautious that you think, you know, you get the feeling it's almost got to be one thing leads to the next, and then we all just go from there, doesn't it? So I suppose that first gig is what's going to set you on the road to hopefully normality, isn't it?
I think so. I hope so. I mean, from what I've heard, that, you know, it'll be socially distanced, you know, so that'll be, I think it'll be kind of strange for both us and the audience, really. Do you know what I mean? I think that there's, you kind of take it for granted, you know, that just that little bit of magic, the exchange between the fans and the band, you know, that is the sort of essence of live music, you know. And I think it'll be quite an emotional thing, man, you know, when it goes back. I think people will be, they'll be really happy to be out and to be seeing the band and whoever else they're going to see and all that kind of thing. But, you know, I wonder, will there be an atmosphere in the crowd? Will it feel different? You know, to give you an example, not long after, you know, the terrible events at the Bataclan in Paris, when the, you know, the people were shot, for a long time after that, I was really conscious of balconies and stuff when we were playing, you know, because you start thinking, is there going to be copycats? You know, people ever thought of doing that before? And I remember it was quite palpable in the audiences as well. You know, it just felt a little bit dangerous, and I kind of wonder, will that be palpable again through the crowd? Will people be nervous that they're going to catch this? Or, you know, there's a lot to consider. But like you say, I think when it comes back, it'll come back full throttle. You know, I think people will be touring all the time. I don't think you'll ever be short on going to see a band because everybody's just ready to go. You know, everybody's just the bags are packed, man. Do you know what I mean? Let's do it.
And other than music, I was going to ask you, I read an article with you in GQ this week. It was back in January, but it's about a TV show you've been doing for the BBC about Auschwitz and the Holocaust and that kind of thing. Is that something we can look forward to coming up soon?
Yeah, well, I'm quite close to finishing it now. I've got 2 days left to film back at Auschwitz, but Poland is really bad at the moment with the pandemic. You know, that they seem to be kind of on fire with it. You know, that the numbers are through the roof, unfortunately. So I'm not sure when I'll get back out there to do those 2 days, but we're pretty close. I would hope to have it edited and finished for the end of the year, but it'll probably coincide with, you know, Holocaust Memorial Day, you know, and I think it's January 27th that will be, and it'll probably be on BBC around about then. But I'm excited about it. You know, it's been amazing. You know, just it's all about musicians who were in the camp, and they basically only survived because there were bands and orchestras and stuff that played there. So it was no exaggeration to say that, you know, being musicians saved their lives. So there's not that many left, you know, surviving members. There's a lady called Anita Laska-Valfish, who's, I wrote the article about for GQ, and she was a cello player. So I've been interviewing her, you know, for the last, you know, 12 to 15 months, and we've just been getting together. And so I saw her 2 weeks ago. Probably that'll be the last interview I do with her for the show. And it's amazing. Anytime I meet someone like that, it's a really it's a really humbling thing, you know. Like you think you've got problems, and then you hear what these people went through and came out the other side. It's quite inspiring.
Yeah, sounds. When I read the article, I thought, oh, that's, you know, I looked it up because I wasn't sure whether it had come out. Obviously, you tell me it hasn't now, but something I'd definitely be keen to watch when that hits our screens. Definitely sounds fascinating. But Brian also tells me you've got a bit of a fascination with Fred and Rosemary West as well, which is interesting because I'm sitting here in Gloucestershire as we speak, and that famous house is probably about 2-3 miles away from where I am at the minute. So just wondering what that it was a podcast you did, wasn't it?
It's the first news story I remember, you know, kind of vividly as a kid, I guess. And I just was always kind of spooked by what happened at, you know, Cromwell Street. Fast forward to last year, and I realised it was 25 years, you know, since that had happened. Then, well, since they got caught, you know, it'd been happening a lot longer than that. But so I thought it'd be cool to try to do some sort of podcast and revisit the case. And so I got in touch with a guy called Howard Soons, who broke the story for the Sunday Mirror at that point, and he donned the House of Horrors headline, and I'd interviewed him, and it was really interesting. But I had an hour's worth, and I thought it'd be quite cool as a series, and I had a few people that I wanted to try to contact. Some I could get, some I couldn't, but the two that were the kind of the best options were Howard, and the other was Leo Coatley, who was Fred and Rosemary West's lawyer. And we did this 2-hour, you know, kind of series of, you know, just basically revisiting everything. It was really interesting, actually. But I'm aware, you know, I think people think I've got a kind of bit of a tendency for the dark things in life, just with my work with the Holocaust stuff and Fred and Rose. And
being friends with Brian McClare as well, of course.
Being friends with Brian McClare, which is the darkest thing that could happen to anybody, really. Do you know what I mean? But I'm not really that sort of downbeat a person, to be honest with you. But it doesn't look good in paper. I don't mean to laugh about it, but it always cracked me up how the news described him as Gloucester builder, Fred West, not mass murderer or, you know, serial killer, or just Gloucester builder, Fred West, as if they were plugging his trades work, you know. It's mad. I went to the house. I went a couple of years ago when I was rehearsing with OCS. We were rehearsing in Bristol, and I had a day off the next day. And I decided, this is as close as I've ever been to Gloucester, so I'm going to go to Cromwell Street and see where the house once stood. And it was quite interesting. I couldn't believe how small a street it was. I just thought people must have known what he was up to. The neighbours are really close. But so what were you going to say, Brian? I interrupted you, sorry.
No, it's all right. Did Fred West not have an ice cream van in Scotland?
He did. He did indeed. He used to drive about Coke Bridge.
He did, yeah. I was going to say, I watched the documentary, and Coke Bridge cropped up in that as well, yeah. Yeah. Always comes back to Coke Bridge.
There's a good chance.
All roads lead to Coke Bridge.
Well, yeah, there's a good chance because my gran lived in Kentwood in Coke Bridge.
That's where my dad's from.
So there's a good. Is he from Kentwood as well?
Yep.
So there's a good chance that I could have been served by. I could have an ice cream cone from that ice
what
cream.
What was your.
Well, they killed his first victim.
What?
The first person
what
ever
year
killed.
Was that, Raymond?
It would have been 60s, but he basically...
Late 60s,
but he was run out of Scotland, you know, because he killed someone in his van, and they reckon, you know, there was another...
He hit somebody, didn't he?
Yeah, but it was a three-year-old, it was a kid, you know, just a little boy, and but he was never tried for it, you know, and there was also three or four... prostitutes had gone missing around about that time as well, and you know, it's never really been fully investigated. So I find all that quite interesting, and it's even more kind of grisly, as you say, you know, when it's your area, you know, especially Coke Bridge and places that are familiar to you. It's
all right with Brian. So, Raymond, we like to get to know our guests here on Life with Brian. So we thought we'd ask you to submit what we're calling our football CV. Now you mentioned earlier you were a United fan from an early age and a Brian McClare fan, of course. But we just thought we'd ask you a couple of questions to put in the CV. So can you tell us your favourite ever player? And I'm obviously assuming you're not going to mention our host.
Well, Maradona, Diego Maradona.
Yeah.
Easily.
Why Maradona?
He was the first person that I remember being, you know, different from other players. You know, even when I was young, you know, I just thought he was from another planet. I'd never really seen anyone that had ball control like that, and just the way he was just so skillful, and he just looked as though he wasn't built for what he could do, if that made sense. Yet when he had the ball at his feet, it was like nothing was more natural than that. I just was mesmerised by him from a young age and kind of followed him all the way through my life up until his death last year. I remember he came to Hampden Park, I think it was 2008 or 2009, and he was the manager of Argentina and they played Scotland in a friendly. And I went with my dad and... You know, we seats quite close to the dugout. I hardly watched the game. I just sat and stared at Maradona for like the entire time. He was hands down my favourite ever. I loved him. Honest, I was so sad when he died. I hope to meet him one day. Do you know what I mean? But it won't happen. But yeah, he was the main man. And then Jockey, obviously. Do you know what I mean? Close second.
Yeah. I was going to say the Maradona fascination. Well, I can't say fascination again.
I was trying to think of several things about what Maradona got up to that I would be, you know, never mentioned about football skills without thinking any other particular things.
I take it your fandom of Diego wasn't purely because of what he did at Mexico 86, Raymond.
Oh, it's a great goal, wasn't it?
Come no, I mean...
It was a wonderful goal.
I was only four when that happened, so well, I wasn't really, you know... It was more, it was a bit later on. You start seeing videos and start become more aware of players and what they're doing and how they're influencing games and all that kind of thing. And he just seemed like, well, he was a superstar. You know, he was just I don't know. Pele was obviously before my time and see the videos and all that kind of thing, George Best. But Maradona he was just my guy. You know, my main man. Just thought he was amazing. The best ever.
Okay, so that's the first one of this football CV. The next one, next question is favourite ever game. I mean, we've said favourite ever game. That doesn't necessarily mean one that you're at, but I mean, favourite game you've ever watched.
Do you know what? I think I would need to say Man United against Sheffield Wednesday. I think it was 92-93 season. Steve Bruce scored two late headers. And I remember that was just... proper euphoria, you know, just you knew you were going to win the league then and all that kind of thing. It was just amazing. I remember, I think, Alec Ferguson and maybe Brian Kidd on the park celebrating, and it was just scenes, you know. It was amazing, totally amazing. I don't know why that game's always kind of stuck out in my head, as I don't know, especially for Steve Bruce to score two goals like that. And they were both cracking headers, man. Do you know what I mean? The second one the first one, I think it was a kind of came in from across and he kind of looped it and it took ages to go in and it just dropped in. And then the second one was just a bullet from just inside the 18-yard box. And that was
who crossed the ball over for that second one?
Can't remember. I don't know.
Gary Pallister, wasn't it, Brian?
I think it may be, you know.
Yeah, it was Pallister whipped a beautiful ball in from the right-hand side, if memory serves me right. But, yeah, a momentous game for United fans of a certain age, of course. So... Yeah. And of course, and a certain person around this table played in that game, so that helps. Yep. Favourite ever goal?
Do you know my favourite ever goal was a goal by Chris Sutton for Celtic, and he scored a volley against Juventus, and I think it finished 4-3 Celtic. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's what the score was, and he scored this ridiculous volley from about 20 yards out. It was amazing. Absolutely, like, as in being there, seeing it in real time, I think that's the best goal. Either that or the Zidane at Hampden you know, in the Champions League final. He scored that again. It was a like otherworldly, unbelievable strike, you know, to win the Champions League for Real Madrid. Both of those goals really stand out in my head.
Yeah, two crackers. And finally, the best terrace chant or humorous insult towards a player or opposition fan you've ever heard.
That's a tricky one.
Is there anywhere like in that you know of, Raymond, that there's fans who have taken Ocean Colour Scene songs and made them into chants?
Not that I know of, but again, no. The band's kind of split with Steve and Oscar were both Villa fans, and Simon is a Birmingham City fan, you know, so it's kind of split down the middle. I've never been to any of the games on either side, right enough, but I'm sure they must do. Well, do the Liverpool fans not sing Mo Salah to the Day We Caught the Train chorus? Mo Salah. I'm sure I've heard them doing that before.
So it was a Villa-Birmingham split in the Ocean Colour Scene dressing room then?
Yeah. Yep.
Did that ever get feisty at times, or was it quite placid?
Nah, not really, no. I like watching Aston Villa. I think they've got some cracking players. I think John McGinn has been a revelation. I'm sad that he didn't end up at Celtic. I think that things could have been quite different at Celtic if they'd managed to get him over the line. Obviously, Grealish is a great player, but it's good to see them. You know, they've gave a good account of themselves this year, I think.
Just out of interest with this CV thing, I'm just thinking with you, Brian. I mean, favourite ever player, I think I could answer that for you, Jinky Johnson.
Yeah, favourite ever. Yeah, favourite ever player, but Jimmy Johnson, yeah.
Favourite ever game?
That's impossible.
Okay.
The games that I've played and games that I've watched, I don't have any favourites of that, you know. Even the worst ones, even the ones where... It's funny, when I went for a walk earlier, and it popped into my head something to do with a question, you know, have you ever been, what's the sort of thing, you know, that because Raymond's been a big United fan, is like, you know, we were talking about the thing there about, what was the question again? You talked about the chant or comment, what did you say about the fans' comment?
Best terrorist chant or humorous insult towards a player.
Oh, yeah, so you're talking about insults or sort of humorous comments or just comments that weren't made in humour. Was that I once got asked at halftime if I knew what colour of shirt we were wearing. which it wasn't quite in the same kind of way that I've just said. It was more like, do you know what fucking colour of shirt you're wearing?
And I don't think there's any prize of a guessing who asked that question.
And it was a game at Goodison, and I had managed. I'm proud of it now. I wasn't particularly pleased at the time, but I'm proud of it. In the first 45 minutes of that game, I did not pass a ball to a red shirt once in the whole 45 minutes. So the comment was incompletely correct, factual, as well as many other things. Sometimes you have, I don't know if you have the same sort of thing when you're playing concerts or gigs or whatever, Raymond, but I just failed miserably to pass the ball to anybody.
Did it get any better in the second half? Did it improve in the
second half? I was brilliant in the second half. Yeah. And then from that moment on, I think the physio said to me, he said to me before we went out, the last just before we go out, he would say to me, remember, we're wearing red today, or remember, we're wearing blue today, or remember, we're wearing white or whatever, you know. So it was the sort of thing that that people were amused at because they were the brunt of it, but it was probably the worst 45 minutes I've ever. And the more I tried to pass it to the rest, the worse they seemed to get. You know, it was just like, I need to get out of here. But he kept me on, and I think I did improve in the second half. And I think, I don't know exactly, but I think it was a favourable result for us. But
I'm trying to think what game that was. Can you remember what season that was?
No, I don't really want to remember it. It popped out of my head when I was out.
Well, obviously,
when you were going on about, terrace chance or whatever, I didn't need to have it from the terrace.
You're getting lambasted by your own seat.
Well, I didn't know. I merely said one thing. It was straight to the point, pertinent, correct.
Jockey's choice. We have to talk about music, don't we? Having an actual proper musician on the podcast. Brian, Ray, did you both see the recent Sky Arts documentary called Teenage Superstars about the Glasgow music scene in the 80s and 90s?
No, but I think Brian did.
Yeah, I watched it, yeah.
So come on, tell us about it, and also tell us about some of the bands who were involved and, you know, the influence they had on you, and also the general British music scene.
Well, I mean, that's my time. That's when I first started buying records, vinyl, in 77, going forward through. And then when I had some disposable income, that was the time, the early 80s, when I was at Celtic, Motherwell and Celtic. So I'd always I loved music, and you wanted to buy and listen to it, I was, again, because I'd been successful in football, I had my own place, so I could play music relatively loud without your parents telling you to turn it down. The program was kind of, it ended up being a lot to do with Bell Silver, where I was born, although I wasn't brought up there. I was born because of the maternity baby hospital was there, baby factory as it was known, colloquially. But look, quite interesting, quite a few. There was a lot of music came out of Bell's Hill. But my favourite, I suppose, at the time was Jesus and the Mary Chain, who I still love listening to that, because it seemed to be something that was so different. I still would say it was still fresh and now when I listen to it, and then even out of that, they have someone who's not, maybe you could say, was a bit part player, that goes on to be part of another wonderful group in Primal Scream, who had huge success.
What I got from watching it was, you know, it's obviously a very small part of the country, very small part of Scotland, and, you know, you've got a huge amount of bands and talent right there on your doorstep, so to speak. I mean, were you aware of these people floating around? I mean, did you see familiar faces a lot? Was it, you know, were they there in front of you, or were these guys sort of?
No, I think the I don't know if it's the same for Raymond, but the very similar things is that when you're in places that you're growing up in towns in Lanarkshire and in Glasgow, is that you're looking at what you would aspire to, and what the main things to aspire to were playing football and playing music. They were things that football clearly was easier, in that you only needed a ball and some people, and then a rough patch of ground. Music, you had to have some kind of benefactor, usually your parent, who would facilitate that and buy you a guitar. A lot of the times we were buying guitars or other musical instruments was at the time would be the catalogue. You know, where you could pay it up over a period of time. So, in part of the kind of fascination of things when you looked at catalogues in the days of the things, oh, you could get it. There's no way you could get it right away, but you could maybe get it shared amongst several people. So, if you're in a family of a considerable size, you know, the one I was in, there's five children, your parents, maybe a chance you could get that pair of football boots or that guitar if your parents could pay it up over a long period of time. And I think that because you didn't have anything and you had time, you devoted your time to that. So I devoted my time running about, kicking a ball about. Other people that I knew devoted their time to practicing and playing musical instruments, although they didn't go on to have the kind of success that those groups had. But I can see where that dream would come from. It's because I think a lot of it comes from the dream. I don't know. What did you dream of, Raymond? When you were, apart from taking pictures of the moon and sending books to Iran, you must have dreamt of. I don't know. Did you dream? Did you have that as a? Was music a big thing? Was it the guitar or drums?
From a young age.
Or the ukulele? Was it the piccolo? I don't know.
No, all I wanted to do was send parcels to Iran. It's my earliest memory. You know, it's just wanting to be able to do that someday. I guess it was always, well, I'd like to be in a footballer, but I didn't really have any kind of natural ability for it.
No, there's no such thing as the natural ability. So that's not it. There's no talent. There's no natural ability.
We talk about this before, talking about daydreaming and when does that stop and why. I think you told me a story once about how you may have been given a talk at a school or a college or something like that, and you were asking the teachers and the, you know, the professors and that kind of thing, what do you dream of? What you know? And they were looking at you as if you're mad because, well, when do you stop daydreaming? I can kind of relate to that because I think I've been a daydreamer all my life, really. Do you know what I mean? All I ever wanted to do was to be a musician, to be in a band and all the rest of it. And I mean, it's mad with the Ocean Colour Scene thing, really, because I grew up such a big fan of theirs. And I mean, I was doing two paper rounds, worked in a chip shop, you know, to basically facilitate going to see them all over the place, all over the country. When they come to Scotland, didn't even need to be Glasgow. I'd just be there. I'd be there front row, queuing up for hours. And as fate would have it, you know, all these years later, I'm playing with them now. You know, it's just a kind of strange thing that's happened. But now all I ever wanted, you know, was to not even, you know, just to make a living as a musician, you know.
How did that story happen, Raymond, if you don't mind me asking? I mean, did the opportunity come up and you just auditioned, or did you talk your way into it? I mean, how do you get to play in the band that you were so keen on?
Well, I had I'd done some solo gigs with Steve Craddock, and we'd kind of kept in touch. I think that would have been December 2014. And by April, May in 2015, I had done a kind of solo show with Simon Fowler, who's a singer. And it was in King Tut's in Glasgow. And I'd opened for him. And I'd had a really, like a fucking horrible gig, man. You know, just the crowd just talked all over the set. It was an acoustic thing. It was just one of those nights. It was a Friday night. Everyone was pissed up, not interested in the support. They were there to see Simon, as they should be, do you know what I mean? But as I was leaving, I was saying goodbye, and the manager just said to us, look, Steve plays with Paul Weller as well, you know, and basically there's a bit of a clash. Would you cover on lead guitar for a couple of gigs in the summer? And I thought, wow, that'd be amazing. I'd love to do that. So I did the two gigs, and it wasn't the same because Steve wasn't there, but it was the next best thing, you know, and I really enjoyed it. But the I don't know, a couple of weeks after that, there was a phone call, and it was just along the lines of, would you like to join the band on bass? You know, so I ended up, I'm a guitarist, you know, but they wanted a new bass player, and I did it. But funny enough, as fate would have it, you know, I think I told you this before, Brian, but my first ever, you know, like my first ever time on stage with them was at Old Trafford. So all those kind of teenage dreams of playing at Old Trafford, they kind of came about, you know, and Dion Dublin was there and Andy Cole were there. You know, it was a kind of corporate thing they were doing. And so I can say I've played at Old Trafford, but just not the way that I'd imagined.
Who did, I mean, Brian mentioned the Jesus and Mary Chain there, and some of the bands in that documentary were obviously from a slightly earlier era. I know Teenage Fan Club kind of overlap, don't they? The sort of 80s and 90s, which is kind of overlapping both of your ages. Were there who else from the local music scene in Glasgow? I know, again, if you were born in 82, then you were really sort of getting formed musically throughout the mid to late 90s, but which you know, you can easily rattle off a load of Britpop bands, let's say. Ocean Colour Scene, of course, were around that time. But were there any particular Glasgow bands, other than, say, Teenage Fan Club, who the first one that springs to mind for me, Primal Scream, again, who kind of overlap the two eras, that you would say were, I don't know, local heroes in a way?
Travis all day, man. I think Travis had such a big impact on me, and I can remember the first time I saw them, because I went to see Oasis on the Be Here Now tour on the 8th of December, which is your birthday, Brian, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, I remember that. 1997. And as usual, we were there early to be at the front row and all the rest of it. Didn't know who was supporting. They'd never heard of this band, Travis. And they came on, and I think they must have played a couple of songs before they even said hello or anything. And it was just like a kind of, like, really dramatic moment when I realised, this guy's Glaswegian. This is unbelievable. You know, like, I didn't realize how has this happened? How can he be playing with Oasis? This is blown my mind, you know. And I met Fran Healy afterwards that night. He signed my ticket, because they were amazing. You know, they were touring the Good Feeling album at that point, and they were just about to become, you know, a big, you know, a pretty well known band. It was before the Man Who and stuff, but they were a lot heavier in those days before the Man Who. And they just blew me away. And then years later, I discovered they'd actually gone to the same school as me. Fran had gone to Holyrood Secondary in Govan Hill, which had also, you know, Jim Kerr had gone there. There was a kind of rich musical kind of history there. Jerry Cinnamon went there, you know. It's kind of, I don't know, Travis are a really, really important band to me. And it's funny now, because I live just, you know, not too far away from Dougie Payne, who's the bass player, and I stopped him in the street one day to just tell him how, you know, I probably wouldn't be a musician if it wasn't for Travis, you know. And I think they're really underrated, especially I think Fran's an amazing songwriter, and they make it look really great. And I also don't know many bands that they just seem to be as sort of tight friends wise as they are. You know, they seem to really enjoy each other's company, and that. That's a rarity in music, you know, from my experience. It doesn't always work like that, but Travis make it look really, really nice. And, you know, they've just kind of been a constant all the way through my own musical sort of journey, you know. But yeah, that night in December changed everything. Life went into kind of technicolor that night when I realised, fucking hell, man, they're from Glasgow. They're playing with Oasis. I want to do that. And last year, well, 2 years ago now, I feel we've lost a year through this pandemic, but I was lucky to go and do some gigs with William Gallagher in Australia when I was playing with Jerry Cinnamon, and that felt kind of full circle, man, you know, like to get to play before Liam, and it was pretty special.
Did he remember washing Brian's car?
He didn't mention it, no.
McClare's mailbag.
It's mailbag time again, and it's been a bumper crop this week, so we'll keep some for another time. Matthew, would you do the honours, please?
I've been rummaging around in my sack, and the first question to come out is from Mark Dawson, and he says, had Alex Ferguson left the club in 1990 when it was famously claimed the FA Cup run saved his job, would you, Brian, have been willing to stay at the club seeing as Fergie was such a big part of you signing for United?
Yeah, I wanted to play for Manchester United. Fergie was the one let's go back to the beginning. I've been a Manchester United fan from the time that they got relegated. When I was 9 years of age, and they were my team, so I wanted to play for Manchester United. Alex Ferguson went to Manchester United. Much to my surprise, he wanted to sign me out of all the players he could have signed in Britain at the time, certainly parts of Europe. He was the one that he wanted to sign me, and I was bowled over with that. I've totally bought into what he said when he said that I'm intending to rebuild a great football club. I thought that was something that, to me, it was a great dream to have. Never imagined that it would have turned out the way it had. And I really enjoyed being there. And when you sign for someone, Mike and I, there was that you sign a contract for somebody, you honour that contract. And if Alex Ferguson had happened to have left or his time was finished, then it would have been my contract was with Manchester United, and I would have stayed, and things would have been totally different, of course, whoever had come in after that. But my contract was with Manchester United.
Yeah, how different things could have been, eh? So, Andy Green, he asks, do you remember playing the Irish Army team at the Cliff, which was United's old training ground, for anyone that doesn't know, in the late 1980s?
Yeah, I do remember that, yeah. Yeah, there was all sorts of... that was one of the things about the... Yeah, I remember playing the game, yeah. Why was that a...
Andy's asked you the question. I mean, I think we're waiting.
Oh, yeah, I do remember the game, but I don't remember anything to do with this, with goals or if I...
What was the story? I mean, was it...
anybody?
How did that game come about then?
That would mean I couldn't tell you how that game came about. You know, it's like playing the first game that Sir Michael played. We played South Koreans, and it might have been the South Korean national squad at Littleton Road, and we got absolutely battered by them. I think they were maybe, we got them, so it's like games just kind of appeared for various different reasons.
So it was like a training game, pre-season friendly, something like that?
It was a training game, yeah.
Okay. Andrew Sheikh, he says, and this is quite topical, seeing as pubs are supposedly going to be open soon. Well, south of the border next week. Where you're from, I'm not quite sure. But Andrew says, which pubs in Edinburgh? Well, hang on. He says, which pubs in Edinburgh do you recommend for a pint and a good day out when lockdown lifts?
It depends on what you're looking for. I would recommend to anybody starting off at the Grass Market and then working your way over the Royal Mile. And then down onto Rose Street, I think you would have a very eclectic time, depending on which pub you were in, and a very enjoyable time.
Would you not name any particular ones? Just that rough area? When I say rough area, I don't mean, you know, I'm talking about Bells Hill and Coke Ridge.
It might have been rough in the past when they used to.
Yeah, you don't get any rough areas around Edinburgh, do you?
The Grass Market when they used to hang people, you know. So
just a general wonder. You're not suggesting anywhere in particular. You're just saying.
I suggest start at the Grass Market and then wander up and then wander down the other side.
Okay. Well, having done that crawl with you last year, roughly, I can recommend it myself, although I barely remember it. Philip Taylor, he says, and I remember this, do you remember missing a header at Newcastle and the whole nation, live on ITV, saw you shout, bastard?
Yeah, I do.
This was Newcastle versus United, 88-89 season, live on the match, in front of millions of people. You missed the header, and you, the camera cut to you as you shouted, bastard.
It's not just missing a header, it's a terrible miss. I think it came off one of my tusks.
Well, if your hair was like it is now, you'd have probably buried it. Because
My ponytail might have knocked it in.
Yeah,
but it was a terrible miss, and because you're totally engrossed in the situation, I would have thought the same kind of thing with anybody that's involved in a performance, whatever performance that is, poor performance by me with regards to that particular moment, and you react to the disappointment. You might have played a bum note. You might have turned the wrong way, or it's just to utter your emotional kind of thing and your disappointment of what you've managed to do, when really it was an easier thing to do was to score than it was to miss. Yes, and I ended up in the back of the goal and shouted or screamed bastard.
So what were you more upset about, missing the chance or the fact that...
Then I noticed there was a camera in the stanchion, but by then it was a wee bit too late to do anything about. So I got chastised by several people, and there was within family and extended family, there was several candles put up in order to save my soul, because at that moment I was destined to go to hell.
It's from a music.
Yeah, I vividly remember. You remember some of the worst things, and that was like, it was a bad miss.
Well, I remember it.
And then it ended up with, and I got around when I got home, yeah, because I think the kids had seen it as well. So
yeah,
I think the kids were watching it, and it was like, Mommy, is that a bad word Dad said? No, I think he said blaster or something like that.
Oh, blast it.
Well, if it's any consolation, I remember it vividly, and I was as upset as any 12-year-old kid would have been at the time.
It was shocking, really. It was shocking.
From a music point of view,
I don't recall exactly what was said to me after the game. What was the score in that? What was the score in that game?
Nil-nil.
Yeah.
It's a terrible game. I think Mirandini was playing for Newcastle at the time. It was it was a terrible game.
Yeah, it was shameful, really.
The only thing that game is remembered for is that you...
Well, it's shameful now because I'm quite proud of it, as being a little part of all these other things that fattened my life, you know. So I'm more than happy that I'm remembered for shouting bastard as loud as I possibly could on live television than I am for missing the chance.
It's added to your credibility.
That's something else. Not added, but just my enjoyment of what I could talk about and that happened to me. Oh, same sort of thing. Yeah, when I was walking to school dreaming of being a player, one of the things I'm determined to do, I'm going to swear on live television as loud as I possibly can after not doing something that I'm supposed to be able to do 99 times out of 100.
I was going to say,
I'm more pleased about that than lots of other things.
From a music point of view, Raymond, have you done stuff before on stage where you think, I've just done this and I know everyone's going to realise and lambast me for it? Are you quite good at just sort of, winging it and hoping that no one's going to, in 30 years' time, going to be asking you embarrassing questions like this?
Well, I had my moments when I was younger. You know, I stopped drinking about 11 years ago, but in the kind of mad old days, used to fall over, and there was a kind of infamous night at the Glasgow School of Art, and I took a header over one of my guitars and snapped it in half, and the gig got cut short because my guitar was in two or three pieces, you know, I couldn't do it. But yeah, it was the people that were there remind me of that. But nothing to, like, I've never missed a header. Do you know what I mean? I don't know.
I think it was 3 yards as well. It was as well. 3 yards, if that.
Yeah, it was that close, yeah. Because I ended up in the back of the net through my momentum. Might have been closer than that. Might have been 3 inches I missed it from.
And you got a ball looking for that?
I don't remember that, but I remember my whole career has been full of bollockings.
Life with Brian. We'll call it a day there. Thanks, Brian and Matthew, as always.
No problem.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Ray, for coming on and putting up with us.
No, anytime. I've loved it. Loved it. Hope to do it again.
What have you got coming up in the next wee while that people should look out for, COVID restrictions permitting, obviously?
I think we're going to play it's a Bedford Park, I think, with Ocean Colour Scene on the 31st of July. And then I'm going to be out with Jerry Cinnamon from, I think it's August, at Reading and Leeds Festival. We start there, and then that's it through to the end of the year. And then the Ocean Colour Scene thing picks up again in December. We'll get a kind of Christmas type tour. So fingers crossed we can get to play, you know. And come and see us, you know, if you're in the area, come and see us.
Certainly will. Fantastic.
If you're playing Whitney Bay answering game up.
Yeah, we're on before wet.
Hey, listen, don't mock the wets, right? They sponsored Clyde Bank once upon a time. You can't get any hipper than that.
I remember it. I remember the strip. It's when Ken Eady played for Clyde Bank in those days. Used to go to Colbowie Park occasionally and see them. Yeah.
Ah, what a stadium that was. Like the benches that were around the ground once upon a time?
There was offices. It was bizarre. If someone hit a shot wide, or if Brian had attempted a header or something, you know, it was like almost smashing a window. It was crazy, just the way it was set up.
Some of the great missed places of Scottish football, eh?
I played there.
Colbowie?
Yeah.
It's not there anymore, is it? It's gone?
No, it's gone, yeah. One of the bizarre things about that is that Claybank became Airdrie.
That's right. Who are great rivals of Albion Rovers from Coatbridge. Everything leads back to Coatbridge.
I may have to try that now. You know, whoever it is, it's on, I have to go get it back to Coatbridge, yeah. You know, your band last week, all the members were from Coatbridge apart from one.
I don't think we can beat Fred West leading it back to Coatbridge.
You can follow Ray on Twitter at raymead82, and his website is raymondmead.com, so keep an eye out there for all the stuff that Ray's got coming up. We're on Twitter at Brian McClare Pod, so come and say hello anytime. And if you want to post something for the mailbag, please do so by using the hashtag AskChockey. Don't forget to spread the word about the podcast if you would be so kind. And of course, don't forget to hit subscribe on whichever platform you are listening to us on. Until next time, please take care, and we'll see you then. Cheers.
Network.